right, welcome listeners to episode 62 of Know Your Enemy. I'm Matt Sittman, your podcast co-host, and I'm here with my great friend, Sam Etherbell. Hey, Sam.
Hi, Matt.
Recovered from my birthday party yet?
Honestly, it took a whole day, but yes. I'm glad you only get a year older once a year, because I couldn't handle it.
Well, we're here to introduce a really great episode, one I'm excited to share. Sam, who's our guest today?
We have Damon Linker on the pod.
Yes, our listeners should know something about Damon. He's someone I've actually known for years. We mentioned his book, The Theocons, in the third of our Roe trilogy episodes.
Right.
He used to be an editor at First Things, kind of broke with that crowd, that scene, for reasons we get into in this episode. But now, this will be of interest to our listeners too, he runs a Substack newsletter called Eyes on the Right, which is really dedicated to analyzing, well, what's happening among conservatives and on the right.
And he does that from his own kind of idiosyncratic political position, which is different from ours because he's not a leftist. And it's useful. It's useful. His Substack is really good and comes at these questions from a slightly different vantage point than we do. And I like reading it.
Yeah. He's also, this might help situate him a little bit, he's a fellow at the Niskanen Center, the kind of bleeding heart libertarians, former libertarians.
Yeah.
I don't know how best to describe their project.
For many years, he wrote a column for The Week. I remember when he was writing for The Week, it seemed like his column came out like every day, but maybe it was like 3 times a week or something. He has an incredibly prodigious output in general, mm-hmm. and manages to be interesting in almost all of those columns. So we were happy to have him on, and his listeners will get a sense of very quickly, he's got a little bit of a Straussian background. He obviously worked mm-hmm. very closely with people at First Things, has a sort of perspective on that part of the sort of Know Your Enemy universe, extended universe. So I think there'll be lots and lots in this conversation for our listeners to chew on. There's also a sort of, you know, political transition narrative here, which, of course, is something that we're always interested in.
Yes. You know, this isn't the main point of the episode, but sometimes, you know, you can disagree with people simply because you just land differently on judgment calls. You're not calling into question their character or intelligence or anything like that, but smart people can disagree.
Yeah.
And I think the trajectory trace in this episode, that's one reason I was happy to do it, just to kind of remind people that, you know, some of these issues are complicated. They might not have a clear-cut, settled answer. And someone like Damon is a great interlocutor because even when we disagree, I never really doubt his good faith arguments or kind of his honesty. He's not a troll.
Yeah. And listeners will be happy to hear that we did manage to pry plenty of gossip out of Damon about his time on the right and working for First Things. And so, yeah, there's a lot to get into. We should get to it.
Yes. Before we do, just a few housekeeping items. As always, we're very grateful for our partners at Dissent for sponsoring the podcast. One thing they do in that capacity is if you subscribe to Know Your Enemy on patreon.com/knowyourenemy for $10 a month, you get not only all of our bonus episodes, but a free digital subscription to Dissent. And of course, for $5 a month, you can get all of our bonus episodes.
And I have a piece in the fall issue of Dissent, which will come out at the end of this month.
I'm looking forward to it.
It's about the Democratic Socialists of America. Have you heard of them?
I haven't. Maybe if I get on Twitter, I can find out some useful information about what's happening with that organization.
Sure you could. I'm sure you could. As always, we want to thank our intrepid producer, Jesse Brenneman, and Will Epstein, who provides the music for the podcast, the beloved music. And I want to remind listeners to rate and review the podcast on iTunes every so often. We love to get a few reviews, especially if they're positive. It helps us with the algorithms, and it helps, you know, soothe the fathomless depths of self-loathing that both me and Matt experience on a daily basis.
Affirm us, affirm us.
All right, well, happy birthday, Matt.
Thank you.
And listeners, I hope you enjoy this conversation with Damon Linker.
Let's get to it. All right, Damon Linker, welcome to Know Your Enemy.
Well, thanks for having me, Matt. I've been a listener to the podcast for quite a long time, a great admirer. I even plugged it in my launch post at Substack.
Oh, we noticed, Damon. We noticed.
That got me on the list. It is a great pleasure to be here to talk to you guys. What you're doing is a real contribution to understanding and thinking about really important stuff. So happy to be here.
Well, likewise, Damon. You may have noticed that I became a paid subscriber to your newsletter only yesterday, but I basically did a crash course in linker thought in the past 24 hours.
Excellent. Everyone should do this.
And I really enjoyed reading Eyes on the Right, your excellent Substack, and I hope all the listeners will subscribe too.
Well, thank you very much for that plug. I think our work here is done.
That's right. Well, Damon, Sam mentioned your fairly new newsletter on Substack, Eyes on the Right, but you know, to get us started and acquaint listeners with who you are, because I think I've known you for years. I think you're one of the columnists I read all the time. Listeners might recall you had a column at The Week for years and years. And that's where a lot of your writing was, on politics and books and culture in recent years. Now you have this Substack. But for people not familiar with you, you know, you had a recent post kind of giving an intellectual accounting of yourself. And you mentioned your influence by Leo Strauss. You mentioned kind of your models for thinking about politics are people like Aristotle, Thucydides, Tocqueville. Could you maybe just tell listeners a little about yourself, your kind of intellectual biography, the short version, and what perspective you're coming from? You're not coming from the exact same perspective we are. So tell listeners who you are a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I am one of these dreaded centrists that you hear so much about.
My favorite centrist. My favorite.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I do try to be a little bit more thoughtful and self-reflective about it than, you know, the old David Broder type who just sort of looks left and right and finds the equidistant point, sits there, and then pronounces himself a wise man. I sort of began on the center left, veered right for a few years, and have ended up on what I think is still the center left, but many on the left would say is more center right. So in other words, each side is sort of shoving me over to mm-hmm. the other. And I guess if I want to be very cliched about it, that must mean I'm doing things right. But I don't think that really proves anything. I mean, I'm 52, so the short version of my intellectual development, you know, can't be all that short, but I will try to do the quick highlights. As an undergrad at Ithaca College in upstate New York in the late 80s, I wasn't particularly political when I got there, but I very quickly fell into being on the left for a year or two because of the, you know, that's what those colleges do, indoctrinating everyone
so
to the
true.
Left. I actually voted for Jesse Jackson in the 1988 Democratic primary.
Oh, wow.
That was as far left as I ever have
that's
gone.
That's admirable, even if it's an embarrassment to you.
No, it isn't an embarrassment at all. Although, you know, sometimes when I tell people on the right that, they're like, whoa, I knew you were bad news. But within a year or two, I had encountered Alan Bloom's Closing of the American Mind. My history here is going to be a kind of summary of past podcasts I think you guys have had. I read that book and it had a big influence on me. I decided, even though I was a history major, I wanted to actually study these great books, because in them, Bloom assured me, was some timeless truth, some timeless moral truth that would ground all of my judgments of the world around me. And that was extremely alluring to me in this way that Straussian education can elicit this longing for eternal truths. But you know, I was coming out of Ithaca College with a history degree, and I didn't get into the University of Chicago to study with Alan Bloom. I didn't get into any of the top Straussian programs. I ended up instead in the history department at New York University, where the big event of those 2 years I was there as a history master's student was meeting Mark Lilla, who was, at the time was in the politics department and had only finished his PhD with Harvey Mansfield and Judith Schlar about 2 or 3 years earlier. And meeting him was a huge influence, and he remains to this day probably my biggest intellectual influence and a good friend. So studying with him both opened the door to what really lay behind the Closing of the American Mind, which is Leo Strauss. So I read a lot of Strauss, but Lilla is an interesting case because he has a bit of a Straussian background, but he also was a Judith Schlar student, and really, I think, is at heart a liberal. So he managed to inoculate me from the Straussian allure and allowed me, eventually, I then applied to various graduate programs, ended up at Michigan State to study with Straussians, and I learned a lot from them, but having studied intellectual history and cultural history of Europe and studied closely with Lilla for 2 years, I was able to do that without ever being completely absorbed into the tribe. I sort of remained on the margins, skeptical, learning things, not accepting a lot of the more cultish, I don't know, tendencies of the school, as it were. And that set me off on my way. From there, I desperately tried to get a tenure track job as a PhD. I taught for a couple of years at Brigham Young University as a non-Mormon, which was a great experience as a teacher, but didn't really have much of a future. And, you know, I just decided, I think much sooner than a lot of people tended to at that time, that, you know what, I'm not going to just apply to a million programs around the country and end up anywhere. I'm going to go into a career with much better job prospects. I'm going to be a journalist. which did work out for me okay, although I you know, remain a little bit on the margins compared to you know, people who rise to the very top. I'm not Tina Brown, who I ended up working for much later, but my first stop was to be a speechwriter for the great Rudy Giuliani back before.
Oh, I always forget about that, Damon.
Talk about a character arc.
Yeah, a character arc for him. And then also, you know, the right-wing world, you know, who hired me, my boss there, one Michael Anton.
Oh, wow, that's right.
Yeah, he was he was the director of communications and the senior speechwriter. There were three of us on staff. I was the junior one because I had just been hired. The senior speechwriter who had been there for years was John Avlon, who is now a CNN talking head,
right.
Writes books in defense of sort of centrist politics and so forth. So it was all right there in the Giuliani administration.
Wow.
And I wasn't there for long. I wanted to get out of day-to-day politics, which I learned very quickly was largely about making the principal, the main guy, look good. And I really didn't want to devote my brain to that goal in life, to make Giuliani or whoever might follow look better by working 18 hours a day and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I ended up applying for and getting a job at First Things, where I worked as an editor for about 3.5 years.
And we'll come back to your time at First Things, Damon. I think for our listeners, your affiliation with First Things will be one of the most interesting parts of your trajectory, what you saw there, what you learned there. But before we get there, I'd be interested in what you took from Leo Strauss, or what does the Straussian influence mean for you practically as you look out at the country and write about politics? Like, what's the Straussian perspective or again, influence on you that you bring? And maybe, too, what kind of Straussians were at Michigan State? That's inside baseball, but I'd be interested in your answer.
Yeah, and your listeners, you know, have enough information at their fingertips from several very informative episodes to make sense of some of this. if the two main camps are typically talked about as West Coast, meaning the Claremonsters, who have gone on to be big Trump fans and derive largely from the thoughts and writings of Harry Jaffa. And then the other school is called like the East Coast Straussians, people like Alan Bloom, Tom Pengel, and to an extent, Harvey Mansfield. I like to say that the Straussians at Michigan State were kind of in Bermuda, like really far east, in the sense that they were not particularly political at all and really just wanted to read Plato. Talk about Socrates. That made them not very political and also very sort of ironic about even caring very much about moral considerations. Not that they were like actively immoral, but they sort of looked down on the cave from outside the cave as kind of, as one of my teachers once said, politics is babysitting writ large.
Oh, wow.
And so they didn't, we studied politics, but entirely as a way of grabbing the ladder to get up and out of the cave. The whole point was to think your way through the things that people cared about in politics and then to leave it behind in favor of doing philosophy that is truly beyond good and evil, not in the, you know, pissant way that Nietzsche tried to do that, but like really beyond good and evil. Like the typical kind of criticism of someone like Richard Rorty, who was very big at the time, would be, well, you know, he says he doesn't really want to engage with anyone who disagrees with him in politics, and he's sort of super ironic about everything. But deep down, he's a totally committed left liberal. And so he is himself still dogmatic. We need to move beyond that kind of dogma ourselves and think more purely beyond the cave. And I both rebelled against that at the time because my attachment to ordinary moral opinion was a little bit deeper than some of the people there. But I have in the end, it's come to inform my way of doing commentary and punditry in a pretty deep way, not in the sense that I'm always winking at and denigrating moral opinion, but in the sense that I do believe it's important to kind of bracket political and moral convictions when trying to just understand what's going on.
Yeah.
And that does tend to characterize the way I write and think about this stuff. And so that, I guess that's the strangely abstract way of answering your question, Matt, about about exactly what it is that I got from my Straussian education. And it is kind of the diametric opposite of what the West Coast Claremont types are like.
That's interesting.
And really, like one other minor distinction between the different camps. The people at Claremont genuinely seem to believe that understanding and acting in politics must involve really amping up what the Straussians call thumos. I know you mentioned this concept a few times on the podcast, yeah. This idea of part of the human soul being kind of defensive anger, a kind of spiritedness. The thing that a lot of people on the right love about Trump, the so-called thing about how he fights.
Gets their blood up is like an idiomatic way
exactly.
of describing it.
Yeah.
What's the Nietzsche line, Damon? The beast with red cheeks?
Yes,
or
exactly.
Or Trump, maybe orange.
The orange cheeks, yes, and orange everything else. Yeah, whereas the Straussians I studied with, that was not at all the way. I mean, it was kind of assumed that thumos, this kind of spirited anger, is kind of childish and needed to be worked through to determine exactly what human beings actually really want. What goods do we seek as human beings? And emphasize more eros, the kind of desiring part of the soul that longs for a final truth of all things, of the whole. And so thumos was seen as something that sort of distracted you and pulled you off the path toward finding that highest truth. And I very much fall into that latter camp. I mean, I have plenty of thumos in me, but I tend to distrust it and delete those tweets.
That is I'm not sure if we've ever really landed on that particular distinction between East and West, but the Eros Thumos distinction is really interesting. Like, which do you listen to? Which do you distrust? I can imagine there's some people on the Claremont side of things who would feel a loving instinct and go, nope, that's not right.
Exactly. Repress that. Make it go away. I mean, well, you see it there at a subterranean level in the rancorous and ugly fight between Java and Bloom in the late 80s, where Bloom is gay, but he's not out, and he writes about Eros a lot. He ends up writing Love and Friendship, about
a book
about twice as long as Closing of the American Mind, and what is Jaffa's criticism of Bloom and Closing and everything he was doing is basically to be a homophobe and a jerk, and to sort of insinuate that he's corrupt in some decadent moral way. Yep. And so the thumos eros distinction there is really, I think, the nerve of that disagreement.
That's a great point. I have another question about this period, your education time, because you mentioned that your sort of induction into the Straussian cult was tempered by your relationship with Lilla and his intellectual kind of, you know, antecedents. I'm wondering, like, what were those things where you would find yourself going, I'm getting pulled too far in this Straussian direction. Let me talk to Mark and sort of, you know, get some other things to read to pull me in the other. You know, how would you characterize that other direction?
I mean, it's funny. It was partly over Strauss, but it was also over Heidegger. I went through a period in grad school where I was like deeply seduced by Heidegger. And I was just reading him all the time, not just being in time, but a lot of the lectures that at that time were just being translated. Right. I was also working on German to write my dissertation. And there were a lot of his published lectures in German are quite easy to read because they were just him sort of standing in a classroom and chatting. So I would work on my German by, you know, breaking out, you know, volume 65 of the Gesamtausgabe of Heidegger. Wow. And there was a period there where I really had a kind of temptation to sort of just take the leap. And Heidegger is one of those thinkers who can inspire that, a kind of something like a religious conversion, yeah. like an all-encompassing worldview. It's also like a wrench that can be used to just shatter the entire history of Western thought to pieces.
A tool at hand, you might say.
Yeah, a ready-to-hand tool of deconstruction right there. And in this period, I already knew that Lilla was very skeptical about Heidegger. And there was a point at which I started sort of haranguing him, like insinuating in a very kind of high-handed Straussian way, like, why don't you have the courage to really look at these things? This is the truth. Right. And Lilla wrote a very memorable handwritten letter back to me in which he's basically insinuating that, like, I have daddy issues. Like, you're always looking for some teacher to kind of show you the light, and then they disappoint you and you leave them behind. Wow. And you should be a little more skeptical. He was just always counseling skepticism, like, fine, mm-hmm. try on those garments, see how they feel. But then put them down, keep them around, but don't make that your wardrobe. Like, that's my own awkward metaphor. But it very much was just be cautious. And I think for Lilla, that came from the fact that he, you know, he was a teenage convert to a kind of evangelical Christianity that he then worked his way out of. Mm. And it informs his entire, I think, intellectual makeup. You know, don't get fooled again.
Right.
That kind of attitude. And that ended up passing that on to me to some extent. And by the time I got to a certain point, I had inculcated it enough that I was then pretty inoculated from it all on my own.
Lilla, too, was a student of Isaiah Berlin, such a fan of Isaiah Berlin, and who famously dismissed Heidegger in On Political yes. Judgment, just flicked him away.
Yeah, and then Strauss dismissed Berlin as just ridiculous, like not at all serious. He's just a relativist. Yep. So it's interesting that Lilla and then myself, I guess, as his student, try to synthesize these two figures.
Berlin and Strauss.
Yeah. You wouldn't think that Berlin and Strauss could live at peace in anyone's soul. And yet, here I am.
Well, how peaceful is your soul, Damon?
Not very.
Well, Damon, I want to ask you one thing about the Mark Lilla influence. Some of our listeners will know who he is, but probably his best-known book, at least to a broader audience in non-academic circles, was called What the Reckless Mind. And that book was about intellectuals getting involved in politics. People like Heidegger, right, who was a Nazi for a period. And the kind of disastrous interventions of these intellectuals in politics. So I kind of feel like one thing maybe that I see in your work and that you took from this time with Lilla too is a certain understanding of the way ideas in the intellectual life relate to politics. Is that true?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it, I mean, I can't speak for Lilla's trajectory and how he got to this position. I do think for him, it does run through his experience with religion. Whereas for me, it's, well, as we'll get to, there is a religious dimension to my story as well, but it doesn't have quite the same impetus behind it. I mean, I definitely do tend to feel like, I think largely through to the Straussian influence, that politics and we'll call it philosophy, but, you know, the intellectual life, thinking deeply about the world, are in tension with each other, that politics tends toward particularism, toward attachment to this community, not that community, you know, my family, my neighbors, my town, my county, my state, my political community as a whole, whatever the largest extent of it is in the U.S., it's the country as a whole, all 330 million of my good friends here who are my fellow citizens. And those are pitted against, I don't know, Canadians, Russia, China. Each of these are kind of closed entities. And there is always a dimension to politics that will always be us and them, us versus them. And that illuminates something important about the human condition, but it also distorts our judgment about what the truth is. It sort of warps our perspective to lead us to, you know, to speak about Thumos again, to kind of privilege a love of one's own. When we think politically, we're seeing the world partly through the distortions of our own love of our own stuff, mm-hmm. our own place, our own history. And so that has to be acknowledged and given its due. And my work does reflect that sometimes when I write with some empathy about the right. But in the final analysis, it is a distortion. And in order to see clearly and think clearly about the human world, the political world, and then, I don't know, nature as a whole, the planet, the universe in which our dramas take place, one needs to kind of separate oneself from that, stand apart from it, and try to look at it dispassionately from outside the neighborhood, mm-hmm. the state, the political community, and stake out a position where you can analyze, how does China see what we're saying from their point of view? That conviction that one must stand back from and dispassionately try to look at what's happening a little bit apart from the passions that are gripping everybody else around me is part of what I think marks my writing and is a real kinship that ties me to the kind of analysis that Lilla makes of people like Heidegger and Foucault and Schmitt and other of these Europeans who made leaps into being very politically committed to either Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia and other kind of third world communist movements down through the 20th century.
Well, obviously, Damon, we do want to get to your time at First Things, and I'm sure our listeners are anxious to hear about that too. I was listening to an interview with you that you did, and I don't remember if it was on, I get all the Never Trump podcasts confused, The Dispatch, The Bulwark, one or the other of these. But you were talking about how Richard John Neuhaus himself interviewed you for your job at First Things. And in that interview, you mentioned that one of the main things you knew about First Things was having read The End of Democracy Symposium from 1996, and that you told him in that interview, I wouldn't have been comfortable with that being published if I was working there. So, which I was very impressed to hear, and I'd love to hear a little bit about that encounter with him and what you knew about him before and what you thought about him then.
And how you got there, too. How you went from Straussian graduate student to First Things editor.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird story that you can only understand if you know the right, which again, your listeners do know a fair amount about, especially Matt, through your recounting of your own experience. The way it opens doors for allies and friends, and if you're a good member of the team, you end up somewhere,
right,
whether it's on the academic or the non-academic side of things. When I decided to leave academia, as I mentioned earlier, I started just writing reviews for the Wall Street Journal and commentary and National Review. There's like a little period where if your listeners go back into like a magazine article database, there's a period of like 9 months in 2000 and 2001, where I'm in like 16 publications all at the same time, because I just was reviewing everything to get my name out there. And it worked, because Michael Anton picked up the phone and called Gary Rosen at Commentary and said, we need a speechwriter. And he said, how about this guy, Damon Linker? He's a student of the Straussians at Michigan State. Oh, great. Send him over. Wow. So I got that job. And then I'm there working for the mayor, and I hear through the grapevine that there's an opening for an editor at First Thing. So I apply for that, and I send all my clippings from all the other magazines that they all read, and they all think, oh yeah, I read this piece by this guy, he's good. So then I have an interview. First Things was not really on my radar. I was not particularly religious and not really at all kind of wired into the kind of project that First Things was trying to do. Although at this period, I was also moving toward converting to Catholicism, but it had absolutely nothing to do with wanting to be like a First Things person. It was just a weird coincidence, which of course, certain Catholics later called prevenient grace. I know Matt will understand what that means, yes. That everything was sort of coming together providentially at this time. But when it came to politics, it's true that I didn't know that much about First Things. I basically knew two things. One is that as a kind of classical liberal, I was very much in support of the ostensible mission of the magazine, which was to not strip bare the public square, to make it naked, to coin a phrase. Richard John Neuhaus's famous 1984 book, The Naked Public Square. Right. I thought that, yes, in the spirit of pluralism, people who enter politics based on religiously grounded moral assumptions should not perforce be excluded from the conversation just because that is the origin of their first principles. And that's because everyone's first principles are kind of mysterious. Why does anyone believe in rights, even if you're secular? Right. Why? Usually, if you push people, they'll admit it's because I believe there's a kind of innate human dignity in all people that makes it wrong to harm them, to kill them, right, to inflict suffering on them. Well, why is that? Where does that come from? What is dignity?
Right.
You know, very quickly, you can see that it's mysterious. And if people are explicit in saying it comes to me because of religious assumptions, that didn't seem a reason to exclude them.
Right.
So that, I thought, okay, I can buy that. That sounds good. But I also knew about the symposium from 1996 and its aftermath. And I thought that the position the magazine staked out was crazy in that. And I didn't say crazy to Neuhaus, but I did tell him that I would have been on the neocon side of that debate. Now, your listeners probably are aware that when that symposium, The End of Democracy with a Question Mark, was published in November of 1996, it sort of shattered the conservative intellectual world, where largely the lines were pro-life, very religious conservatives on one side were arrayed against people who tended to be Jewish neoconservatives, with the latter group being very agitated about, what is this? This is like the old debates in the 60s where the new left was calling for revolution, and now it's this magazine and the family calling for this.
Right.
I would definitely have been on their side and seen this as irresponsible and imprudent. And Neuhaus, you know, he appreciated my honesty and candor on the subject. And actually, maybe we'll come back to this. This became an ongoing theme in my relationship with him over the next 3.5 years after he hired me, especially about the Iraq War. Our arguments about that nearly always took the form of me saying, I really disagree with you on this. And him saying, oh, Damon, we don't really disagree here. And he doesn't literally give me a hug, but kind of intellectually tries to make a case for how we don't really disagree in the end. It's not a disagreement of principle. It's a matter of prudence, and it's perfectly fine to disagree about these kinds of judgments. Whereas I would then be like, no, I really think you're wrong.
Right.
Let's just say that didn't end well, but I'm getting ahead of myself, I suppose.
Yeah, David, we'll certainly get back to your leaving First Things. But before we do, you know, one thing I was thinking about in preparation for this conversation is, because, you know, we're not talking that much about the book you wrote about your time at First Things, The Theocons, which we've talked about on the show before, especially that third episode of our trilogy on Roe. But I do feel like because we talk so much about figures like Robbie George, Hadley Arkus, Father Newhouse, and issues like abortion and kind of the culture war issues, our listeners might not have a sense of the broader First Things project, which included kind of neoconservatism in foreign policy, and even, you know, economics, someone like Michael Novak, his 1982 book, The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism, right, kind of giving a religious or spiritual gloss to right-wing economics. Could you speak to, like, the broader project there? Would it be fair to call it religious neoconservatism?
I guess I would disagree slightly in just the use of the term religious neoconservative. In the book, The Theocons, I make a big deal about trying to dissociate the theocons from the neocons on a series of assumptions. And the thing that I would say is one of the most distinctive things about the First Things project in this period has to do with what I call lumping, an insistence that all good things go together, with the goodness, of course, defined by the people at First Things. And this is wrapped up with, maybe the best way to summarize it is to bring in John Courtney Murray, who I'm sure you've mentioned on the podcast.
We haven't talked about Murray some, but just for listeners, he was a Catholic priest and theologian who argued kind of around the time of Vatican II for things like religious pluralism, something like a Catholic version of human rights, active in that period on those issues.
Yeah, I mean, it's important for readers to know that the Catholic Church was very critical of both liberalism as a form of government and Americanism, which actually in the late 19th century was deemed its own heresy. And it was only after World War II and the Holocaust being revealed that the church began a couple decade long project of trying to reevaluate things. And Murray was very influential on this, especially a book of his that came out in 1960 on the eve of Vatican II called We Hold These Truths, Catholic Reflections on the American Proposition. And he proposed, John Courtney Murray did, that actually the Catholic Church should love America because America is kind of the place where an entire country that was so powerful it just beat the Axis powers in World War II. It stands astride the globe. And it is founded on a belief in innate human dignity that is ultimately derived from the Catholic Church's teaching going back to the Middle Ages. And so this is the beginning of what I called lumping. So you end up with this position that the Catholic Church is somehow at a deep level continuous with American democracy, rights, and then eventually with the First Things crowd, with the agenda of the Republican Party, which is itself the party that is most deeply in favor of defending Americanism in the sense of the American founding and the founders and venerating them and the kind of deep origin of natural rights in a kind of theological view of a human being, whereas the Democrats used to be that way too, but since the influence of the new left and the counterculture, they've kind of gone off into this secular and really sort of corrupt alternative path that is a deviation from the American norm. And this sort of became what First Things stood for with Richard John Neuhaus, a notion that whether you were talking about the traditional social issues like abortion, gay rights, euthanasia, later stem cell research, these kinds of issues, or Reaganite economic policy, keeping taxes low, limiting regulations, letting free enterprise do its wondrous work of raising everybody up and making everyone wealthier over time. Or to add a third category, foreign policy, the United States as the great beacon for freedom, democracy, human dignity, allied with John Paul II, who over there in Europe is doing his version of the exact same thing, and Margaret Thatcher doing the same thing there with a toehold in Europe, that all of these things are somehow the same, a kind of blurring, like, again, America back to the founding, the Republican Party, Reaganism,
the church,
American foreign policy, using American military might, both to defend freedom and to punish injustice, like the injustice of Saddam Hussein being a dictator. That comes in later, of course. This kind of series of equal signs.
Right.
Somehow all of these things are like the same, that one could have a life as a First Things writer or reader and feel like everything all lines up and makes perfect sense. And that includes being a liberal,
right.
Like that Newhouse wrote a piece, very important piece, in 1997 for First Things, The Liberalism of John Paul II, which is one of the great statements of this, wow. of this equalizing ideology that is what I was writing about in my book, Theoconservatism, that it's not that they wanted to transform America into something new that was more religious. They wanted to reinterpret what America always had been as a kind of sacred enterprise that was equivalent to the Catholic Church going back to the Middle Ages. So like that's how I would summarize what was distinctive about it. And it's interesting because today this is very, very different. The right has changed a lot. Now we're much more likely to hear people on the right, including at First Things, talking in terms of dichotomies, like liberalism or piety,
right.
Trying to open up debates about economic policy. To be a good believing Catholic, you have to, at least in theory, be critical of capitalism and see that capitalism is actually behind pornography and the pornographication of relations between the sexes and so forth.
We were joking before we started recording about whether or not Daniel Bell was my grandfather. I'll let the listeners investigate. But that idea of lumping, which you've defined as sort of the core methodological impulse of the First Things crowd in those years, it's fundamentally anti-intellectual in Bell's definition of the intellectual, which is someone who makes relevant distinctions.
Absolutely. And that is one way in which Bell has always been a major influence on me. One of the epigraphs for the Theocons is a quote from Bell along those lines, that I believe, you know, using reason is usually a faculty of drawing distinctions between things. And I think Bell was exactly right about that.
Well, Grandpa was a smart guy.
This is disinformation we're spreading here. This is what they're talking about at CNN.
Well, you know, Damon, we'll probably touch on this later, but I do think it's worth kind of underscoring now. I mean, we've talked about Newhouse before, but I think one reason the term religious neoconservatism came to mind was he was a left-to-right convert in that sense, but he always claimed to be a liberal still, right? In a way that I'm not sure anyone at that magazine now would.
Yeah, that is true. He wanted to believe very deeply that anyone arguing in good faith and open to the truth would basically end up in exactly his position, and that position was liberalism as he understood it. So again, the liberalism of John Paul II. So like if you read the great long encyclicals that John Paul II put out when he was Pope, whether it was on capitalism or
Faith and Reason,
philosophical expositions of the human person and its connection to Jesus Christ, that somehow that was liberalism. And anyone who is honest would have to concede that they were that kind of a liberal under the surface. And it could be pretty frustrating, but he really did believe it, even though there were these moments like that End of Democracy symposium when he would sort of slip. I mean, one of the stories I tell in the Theocons, and another way in which I distinguish Newhouse and also Novak from the neocons, more properly defined, is that Newhouse and Novak began further left than most of the neocons. And then when he shifted, he ended up sometimes going further right than the neocons, which is what you saw in the reaction to the symposium. There was always something of a bomb thrower in Newhouse. He and Peter Berger, the sociologist, co-wrote this book. I think you guys talked briefly about in that episode 3 of the Roe series. movement and revolution, where Peter Berger was in writing the chapters saying, we don't need revolution. We can get where we're going on the left through liberal give and take and debate and argument. And then Newhouse would write the chapters like, no, we need to make Molotov cocktails and we need to throw them at people. This was, I think, published in 1969. And Newhouse did repudiate that fairly quickly. And, you know, by the end of the 70s was already, you know, leaning in the Reagan direction. So it was a very rapid move throughout the 70s. But then that kind of bomb throwing instinct would come up. And usually it would come up when Democrats were in power. I mean, this was one of the major themes in my final chapter of the Theocons, about this oscillation that you see, right, that I think has become a major theme on the right ever since, which is, oh, if our people are in charge, then yes, America is wonderful. It's this great Christian Catholic project from the very beginning, and it stands for all good things. But if the Democrats are in charge, then we might just have to have a revolution to overthrow the entire system and fix it from the ground up.
Right.
And they would sort of switch back and forth. And that was one of the things that was a little disorienting when I first got to First Things, because it was early on in the Bush administration and 9/11 hadn't even happened yet. So this was kind of the honeymoon period of, oh, wow, Clinton is finally gone. We now have a Republican again, and not just any Republican, but a Republican whose top advisor, Karl Rove, had summoned Richard John Newhouse.
Father Richard.
Father Richard was brought down to the State House in Austin to talk to the candidate about how he should talk about these things, meaning of this kind of social conservative agenda, which was very much the relationship there that Newhouse provided, the kind of rhetorical turns of phrase mm-hmm. that Bush really liked in running and then in governing.
Damon, just a quick question here, because we'll get to 9/11, the Iraq War, you exiting First Things, but how important was First Things to the Bush White House?
Well, Newhouse, while I was working there, was invited down two or three times to meet with the president in the Oval Office, and there are pictures to prove it, although the White House refused to give me permission to publish any of them in the book. It was like, I have the evidence right here. And they were like, no, sorry, we won't let you republish that. So I couldn't do it. But, you know, I have a picture that has Newhouse sitting there right next to Bush speaking with George Weigel and Marianne Glendon of Harvard Law School sitting there in the room having a kind of three-on-one conversation with the president. What would they talk about? Usually, I think it was about, again, these rhetorical issues, like how should I frame this issue about abortion or stem cell research, and, you know, the decision announced just before 9/11 that he would freeze funding for stem cell research, or later on in 2004, how to frame the administration's defense of the constitutional amendment that would have banned gay marriage. They very much followed Newhouse's lead. And again, this goes back to the liberalism point. How do I talk about this thing that will be accused of being a kind of theocratic move? How do I couch it in liberal terms that make it sound like yes. it is just an outgrowth of the liberal project? I mean, Newhouse, as your listeners probably know, when he was on the left, he marched with Martin Luther King and was very much a part of the civil rights movement. And he always viewed the pro-life movement and of the other arms or wings of the social conservative agenda as an outgrowth of the civil rights movement. Like, we're trying to defend the most defenseless. This is expanding the circle of concern to the people who most need protection, whether it's the unborn or for euthanasia, you know, people suffering in various ways from diseases or old age.
Or indeed tyranny abroad.
Or tyranny abroad. That is certainly true. So there was that relationship between literally Newhouse going to the White House. You also had things like George Weigel suggesting lines for the 2005 Bush second inaugural address, which I thought was abysmal and made very clear that I thought it was terrible. It was like the one that mentioned freedom 56 times and talked about, you know, ending tyranny in our world. It was kind of the most hawkish democracy promotion version of the Bush administration's agenda, which made perfect sense given that we've, you know, forgot to find any weapons there or hadn't found any weapons. But the other kind of connection here was Peter Wehner, who I've become friendly with, and I appreciate his writings about Trump. And he's definitely done a lot of rethinking since he left the Bush White House. But he was in the Bush White House, I believe, all 8 years as Karl Rove's deputy. And he was the first things connector. He's yes. the one during the Iraq War. I don't know if people here know the way First Things was run back then, but Newhouse would write a roughly 10,000-word column, and I'm not exaggerating. That's literally a roughly 10,000-word column for every issue.
On the square, right?
Yes. And throughout the post-invasion period, so March 2003 on, say, through the upcoming re-election campaign, he would regularly write about the Iraq War, and he would invariably denounce and dismiss criticisms in the mainstream media about how it wasn't going well and we weren't finding the weapons. And he would instead give administration spin that was coming to him via faxes sent by Peter Wehner that would arrive there just in the common area. You know, I'd walk by the fax machine. There'd be something there. I'd look at it. Oh, another thing from Wehner. And I'd bring it into Newhouse. And that would basically just end up in his column. Wow. And it was just administration spin.
Wow. Wow.
That basically, don't believe anything they say. It's going great. It's going wonderfully. Don't undermine morale. It's going well. And I would then edit Newhouse's column, which really, frankly, you know, he was a great writer, didn't require a lot of line editing. But I would go in and I would say, you know, this is just what Wehner has told you. It isn't true. You really need to read like journalists on this. And he would say, oh, there's dispute about it. I trust Peter Wehner. I trust what he's saying. They mean well. It's going to work out just fine. Oh, Damon. And that was a major impetus to my growing frustration, we'll call it, over the Iraq War.
Let's talk about this because it's obviously of great interest to our listeners that, you know, you broke with this crowd and, you know, pissed them all off by writing that book. And as the person on the podcast who didn't have, you know, a great political transition from right to left, I may be even more interested than Matt in how that happens for somebody emotionally, psychologically, and intellectually. I think people probably underestimate how hard it is to be a part of an institution where we're all on side and we're all on the same team, and then have the kind of fortitude to keep thinking clearly and then, you know, ultimately do something that will be perceived as a betrayal. You know, Matt has talked about on the podcast before, he has good relationships with some people on the right, but some people still just see him as an apostate and they'll never forgive him. And I'd be interested in sort of drilling down a little bit into the sort of texture of both the kind of intellectual and emotional elements that went in for you into breaking with them. You know, what were the things that you saw and what was sort of the breaking point and how did it feel, if that makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not Whitaker Chambers. I'm not someone who, like, I'm not like, say, you know, Joseph Bottom, for instance.
He was the editor after Father Newhouse.
Yes. Very smart guy. I've learned a lot from him over the years, but he was a true believing member of this world. And so if he flipped to kind of the secular right. center left as I did, that would be like an enormous shift that would require right. a lot of explanation. For me, it didn't feel like, oh my God, I'm like, my soul is in jeopardy here. I'm repudiating my deepest convictions, because I was never a true believing First Things guy.
Right.
I was sort of on the intellectual center right and ended up at this job. I did go through a brief period right after 9/11 where I was pretty invested in it. And that was mainly just because I was scared to death by what I saw that day. I mean, the first plane flew over my head. My brother was down near Wall Street at a conference that day, and I worried for a couple hours he may have been killed. So I was scared shitless for a while. And for about 6 months after 9/11, I was like, yeah, rah, rah, on team.
Right.
We're going to, you know, defend the country and make the world a better place because all good things go together, as I said. So I was very into the project for a bit. But as soon as I heard the 2002 State of the Union Address, which is otherwise known as the Axis of Evil speech, I immediately was like, what? We're going to invade Iraq, aren't we? What the hell does that have to do with anything? And I just immediately began coming into the office and being like, this is a mistake. This should not happen. Saddam is a bad guy, but he has nothing to do with any of this. This is Dick Cheney and his friends wanting to kind of settle accounts. They're pissed off that this has lingered on. They feel it's their responsibility to fix this. Maybe Bush himself wants to prove that he's a tougher guy than Daddy. This is just not reasonable. This is stupid. And it's kind of interesting. I remember at the time and even ever since, like, people saying, like, I wasn't sure what we were going to do. Like, I thought from the Axis of Evil speech, I was like, we're going to attack Iraq.
Right.
This is inevitable. This has already been decided. The rest of what we see in the run-up is just going to be how they're going to sell it. What are going to be the precipitating events, like sending Powell to the UN and talking about how he's violated all these UN resolutions. So it'll be like, we're enforcing the UN when the UN won't do it for itself. It was like all obvious way ahead of time. And I remember at some point, probably in the fall of 2002, I went into Newhouse's office and I said, you know, I'd like to write a piece giving the conservative argument against the invasion for our pages. Now, Newhouse didn't blow up. He didn't call me a traitor, didn't say anything. But what he did say is, Damon, you don't want to get a reputation for being unreliable.
Wow. And what a line, unreliable.
Yes, that was what was important. And I knew what he meant. What he meant was he didn't want a call from Bill Kristol saying, why the hell are you publishing this linker guy against the coming war in Iraq? What are you doing over there? He just didn't want to deal with it. And there's a second thread that you guys might not even be aware of. A First Things reader in 2002 and 3 would know this. But when Newhouse said the line about being unreliable, this was also a reference to something else that was going on in this period. Back then, I was writing a column for the magazine roughly every third issue. It would kind of rotate among the editors. And mine was coming up for the November issue. And I pitched a column titled Fatherhood 2002, in which I tried to make the case that men should have a bigger role in raising small children. And I even ended with a plug for Scandinavian style support for families. So that
unreliable.
I know, I've always been unreliable. And you know, again, to Newhouse's credit, he said, fine, you want to write that? That's okay. He okayed it. He read it before publication. And again, I ended with a plug for Scandinavian style support for long parental leave, including paternity leave, so that fathers could be more involved in raising babies.
Right.
And women could work and you could share the burdens. And I even found the requisite biblical quotes to back me up a couple of places to make sure I had, you know, my footnotes. This did not go over well with our readers. This led to an absolute avalanche of basically angry tweets, to put it in 2022 language. This is 20 years ago now. So we got letters, people absolutely eviscerating me and the magazine.
From fathers saying, I fucking hate my kids. I don't want to see them more.
Exactly. Don't you get that my job is a way of acting virtuous for not having to be around here all day? I get to come home and be tired and have my wife give me a beer and a newspaper. Very right. 1950s. So this was fine. I'm a big boy. It didn't bother me that these people were saying this, although it did make me wonder, who the hell are the readers of this magazine? Like, it was kind of like my, you know, the Trump voter experience for the very first time, you know, right. 15 years early. Like, wait a minute, who is the base? Who are we doing this magazine for exactly? But the problem arose that Gilbert Mylander, who is an ethicist, a bioethicist, who I think is still alive. I believe he's taught forever at Valparaiso University in Indiana.
That's right.
He was a long, old friend of Newhouse and a member of the First Things board. He was livid, not so much that I had written it, but that Newhouse had published this. And he wrote a long, very unhappy letter that ran in our letter section in the next available issue. I think it was the February 2003 issue, if your readers want to look it up. And of course, my job now is that I have to write a response to these letters. And I did not hold my fire. I mean, Gil Mylander accused me of having a deep-seated longing to lactate.
Oh my God.
Oh my goodness. That is crazy.
He did. I was furious, and I actually literally said this, and we had to dash out the bad word, but I responded and said, this is the intellectual equivalent of a playground taunt of faggot.
Yeah, yeah.
And so let's just say Newhouse was not happy.
It's the same thing they said about Pete Buttigieg when he took paternity leave. You know, there was like dozens of Fox News segments sort of saying, well, what's he supposed to do with an infant? Does he have tits? No, he doesn't. It's exactly the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, again, did Newhouse publish my very vicious response to this? He did. So he was a liberal at a certain level. He didn't say you can't do that. Gil Mylander's on our board. He's a friend of mine. And when those letters were published with my response, he called up Newhouse and demanded that he fire me. And Newhouse did not fire me. In fact, right around this period, I had applied to succeed Jim Nichterline as the editor of the magazine, and he chose me. Even though all of this was going on, and in the midst of his deliberation, I withdrew from the position. I told him, look, between the Iraq War stuff and this stuff about my kid and what I wrote and the response, I don't feel like I should be the editor of this magazine. And he, 2 days later, sauntered into my office and said, you got it. He offered me the job and I didn't turn it down. I probably should have, because the Theo Kahn's is the result, because I really should not have been the editor of that magazine. But it's a testament to, it's a little bit of the old Platonic bit about how, like, you know, the one person you want to be the king is the one who doesn't want the position. Like, you know, you pick the person who doesn't want power to be given the power. And I think that was his thinking.
Well, if only you'd run it into the ground, you know?
Exactly. That's what set up the break.
When did you actually leave the magazine?
Basically, through 2004, with the magazine coming out with its editorial in defense of the anti-same-sex marriage amendment, which I bit my tongue the whole time, and then the John Kerry campaign, I remained quiet through that whole period, but was working on a proposal for a book. And so when Bush won re-election, I had a proposal ready to go. And I got, thanks to some help from some people, I networked into a top agent who sold it around. And that gave me enough of an advance that I was able to quit. So I did. I announced that I was leaving to write a book about the magazine. And boy, did that make the last couple of months there pretty tense. Newhouse was aware that he had reason to worry. And we had a final lunch where he asked me to read the proposal. And I said, no.
Wow.
I said, I can't. He said, but why won't you let me read it? We don't disagree about that much. And I said, you said that over and over again, but I do. I think this magazine is having a bad influence on the country, and I'm going to write a book to say so. And he was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
He was very scared, and I then heard through the grapevine that he was kind of very agitatedly trying to pull in all of his favors in the book world to try to get his hands on this proposal, and it eventually worked. I heard that Adam Bellow sent him a copy.
So, Damon, you left First Things in 2005. Newhouse dies in January 2009, just as Obama's about to be inaugurated.
Yes, there's something somewhat fitting, I guess, about that, although...
Yeah,
I'm not saying it's prevenient grace or anything.
Right. When you think back on those years, how much have you been surprised by the trajectory of the right? Was it all there? Have you been actually surprised, shocked by certain turns of events, the rise of Trump, so on and so forth? From that vantage point of what you saw then in, you know, Bush's first term and then early in his second term working for First Things, what's your read on just kind of... from that vantage point, what happened?
I mean, I would be lying if I said that I wasn't surprised. I mean, I was predicting in 2014, 2015, that Jeb Bush would be the nominee. I even wrote a column at The Week saying, it's over, it's Jeb.
And you weren't alone in that.
I know. I mean, I grew up in an era of the center-right world where there was a certain sort of, not division of labor, but kind of division of factions on the right that I treated like everybody else treated, except for the, you know, the paleocons who ended up on top. Most of the people treated this as just the way it is. You don't question it. It's the way it works, which is you have the kind of unwashed masses, the kind of people who send angry letters to First Things when an editor says that men should have a role in raising small children. And they're part of the family, but they're like the brutish, nasty uncle who makes a bit of a scene at the Thanksgiving dinner. But the real people in charge are the educated people, the smart people, the people who know the way it needs to run, which is that we talk in a way to make those people happy, but then we come into office and we pursue these other policies that right. are more continuous with broadly defined liberalism. So you can debate whether it was a good idea to use military force to, you know, topple Saddam Hussein, but the impetus that we must overturn dictators and defend freedom around the world is the most liberal of sentiments, going all the way back to the end of the Second World War. I mean, there was something deeply continuous between Newhouse's stance on the Iraq War and Cold War liberalism going all the way back to Truman. And right. so in that respect, even though I wrote a book saying that these people were trying to push American politics in an illiberal direction, and I do still think that's true, compared to what we've seen subsequently, I hadn't seen anything yet.
Right.
So what I do think, and I'm hardly alone in saying this, I do think that what we have lived through since, say, at the deepest level, basically since McCain picked Palin, and then the rise of the Tea Party, and then the clown car primary on the right in 2012, and then finally Trump's announced campaign. Those are kind of the three prior to Trump waves where we were seeing like, oh, something is happening here. There is an attempted revolution from below going on the right, and Trump finally accomplished it. What we are seeing is that the people who wrote into First Things about me getting up with my infant son took over the joint. They said, we want this to be more reactionary, more right-wing, nastier, fewer niceties, fewer gestures toward universalism and equality and human rights, and more about winning power to reverse a lot of that stuff. They right. just, they felt like they were on the losing end of the deal for too long. And that had to do at one level with never overturning Roe v. Wade for all that time. You know, right. you know, here we are loyally voting for all these Republicans. And in the end, what do we get? We get nothing. But then it was also losing in the sense that, you know, Obama won. And then he won re-election again, and not wanting to see that ever happen again. Feeling like if this country is what we think it is, Obama should not be able to win 53%. The only reason he won 53% is because we ran milquetoast, doofus, center-right, liberal John McCain as our candidate in 2008. We should have run somebody else, someone more like us.
Right.
You know, they always hated McCain. I mean, remember McCain and Pat Robertson duking it out the last time in 2000? He was not their guy. And similarly in 2012, Mitt Romney, really? They wanted Michelle Bachmann. They wanted Herman Cain.
Yeah.
And then they were willing to settle for a Rick Santorum. I mean, we don't remember enough that Rick Santorum won as many states as Bernie Sanders would eventually win. This was a big thing going on, and they ended up winning. And I did not expect it, but in retrospect, it isn't that surprising because those folks were always there. And perhaps we were being naive on the center-right in thinking that they would accept this arrangement indefinitely.
Naive and hubristic.
Yeah.
In a way, when we have these sorts of conversations that sort of define the change from the sort of Reagan order style conservative to the Trumpian, and we sort of describe it in these populist terms, a revolt of the base, you do have to keep in mind the hubris of this sort of self-understood best and brightest thinking, we can just keep on, as Matt has said, riding the tiger, and we should be in charge, you know, and of course we're in charge, and we should be, and it'll always be that way. You know, it's a very unfortunate turn of events, but there's a degree to which it took two to tango. It took the sort of hubris and naivete of those running things and the sort of resentments and burning, you know, the thumos of the base to result in what we have now.
Right. And the way you framed the question was actually as much about the intellectuals. And I would just briefly say that I really do think that they have simply been running along behind, trying to make sense of it and reconstitute things in order to take advantage of what they hope will be the political advantage of this revolution that's gone on within the coalition on the right.
Right.
You know, I remember there was a brief period just before Trump won when Rusty Reno was actually being very friendly with me. And he invited me to a dinner. And Rusty was inviting people who are not on sides with the First Things agenda, but just smart people he wanted to hear from and talk to, you know, just talk about, you know, what is this Trump thing? You know, should we vote for this guy coming up? It was about a month before the election, I think, in 2016. And Rusty was already kind of really inclined to like think this was going to be a good thing, this change in a more populist direction and overthrowing Reaganism. And my sense at the time was I was only willing to give him credit for like, oh, you're just a few steps ahead of everybody else here.
Right.
Everybody else will be coming along soon enough. And you know, soon enough, that's exactly what happened.
Right, right, right.
I mean, a few people didn't, and they formed the Dispatch and the Bulwark.
Yeah.
But everybody else pretty much just kind of stayed on the right and just adjusted all of their assumptions and expectations.
They were reliable.
They were reliable, exactly.
One of the things that's interesting to me is that I actually see your work, Damon, as somewhat different from what they do. And I have a sort of theory about this, which you don't have to agree with. But I think that some of the Never Trump conservatives, people like Bill Kristol, Charlie Sykes, Stuart Stevens, they have a strong desire to interpret everything that Trump does as uniquely bad and like unprecedented and beyond the pale and nothing like what we used to do when we were a part of the Republican Party. And I think there's a part of that impulse that is guilt, you know, about their complicity in sort of making the bed that Trump has slept in, that we're all having to sleep in, and a part of it that's trying to quarantine him from the party that they helped to build and support. Obviously, a lot of these people have done mea culpas and sort of acknowledged the ways in which they were complicit. But I think the impulse is still there. And I think that can cloud their judgment in a way that I don't see your work as being as clouded. Because as you said, you were always unreliable. You feel less of an impulse to do this kind of work of disavowal. And I think that results in this, what I would describe as sort of admirable equanimity in your work, in your ability to, you know, make distinctions between, well, this is very bad, but it's not like completely unprecedented. And to try to sort of see things politically and not have your judgment be kind of clouded by these unconscious desires. I would say also, though, that there's another side of sort of Trump watching, which is from the left. And I think it also has its own pathologies. I think that sometimes if you're fully a partisan of the left, there's a, for different reasons, an impulse to see everything that Trumpism consists of as uniquely evil and or stupid. There's a kind of sort of just affective draw towards denunciation and panic, which I think we try to avoid on the podcast too.
Yeah, I mean, all I'd add to that is that, I mean, as much as I detest Trump, and believe me, I do, and I've actually, I think, gotten better at this over the years as I've seen more and reevaluated stances that I took early in the Trump administration in light of how things turned out. I don't think there's that much value in writing the 757th column that basically boils down to screaming, "Oh my God, look what he's doing." That might have been worthwhile early on because he was new and scary and not like any president any of us have ever seen. But it's you know, in the end, we don't get that much out of it. We get it. Yeah, he is dangerous. He is nasty. He represents something in kind of the American psyche that has always been there. You know, Southern slave owners, the know-nothings, the people Mark Twain often writes about with an arched eyebrow, all the way down through Jim Crow and various retrograde John Birch style people throughout the Cold War. Like, this is kind of the id of America, and it's always been there, and it's always influenced both parties to some extent. It emerges in weird ways, like George Wallace in 1968 is a huge surging forth of it that gets 20% in Michigan and a few many other states throughout the South and the Midwest. And then it recedes, and then it gets sublimated into Reagan in kind of weird ways, but then largely, I think, repristinized kind of through his universalistic instincts in a way that is mostly benign, but it's still there. And then it's there in various other intellectual movements through the 90s that Nicole Hemmer talked about very intelligently recently on one of your episodes. So it's always there. And what Trump is, in my view, is that rising up to a level of direct political power that is itself unusual.
Right.
We haven't seen that before yet. I mean, maybe Andrew Jackson was that in the 1820s and 30s, but that's a long time ago. And the issues at stake and the power of the state back then was so different that it almost doesn't make much sense to draw the comparison. It doesn't illuminate that much.
Well, Damon, for all the fellow feeling kind of I have for your work, I mean, I was an early subscriber to Eyes on the Right. I read you all the time. Obviously, listeners know this conversation we've just had is a lot of agreement. But some places where you disagree, I would say, with the left, but also, you know, many more mainstream liberals and Democrats, is over issues like, well, pick an issue from January 6th to the latest, you know, stealing classified documents, those kinds of issues. And I feel like our listeners should understand where it's coming from in your work, you know, the necessity of making distinctions. And one of them you make, you wrote a big New York Times op-ed about this back in August, August 21st, called "There is No Happy Ending to America's Trump Problem." And one thing you do there is make a distinction between a political problem and a legal one. And that you say the Trump phenomenon is finally a political problem. And so it can't really be remedied with legal maneuvering. I mean, I feel it's so classic Linker in that you're deflating the idea that all good things go together, right? That we could prosecute Trump and it would work and he wouldn't run for president again and the problem would be solved.
Yeah.
You know, I think you're disabusing us of that.
Well, let me describe what lies behind a stance like that, but it also lies behind other positions I've taken that you guys might disagree with. I guess I would say most Americans who are alarmed about what Trump represents fear tyranny. They think fascism is on the horizon. Trump is the leading edge of it. We're going to end up as a dictatorship under the boot heel of a kind of right-wing Republican Party fascist regime. And I agree that that's a danger and something I worry about a lot. I did a two-part post about a month or so ago on the Substack about the fascism question, and ended up describing Trump not as a fascist, but sort of fash-ish.
He's a bit fashy.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I love John Gantz's Substack too. And in the end, we ended up in a similar place about Trump, because his view is also that he's not strictly speaking a fascist, but there definitely are fashy things about him. But that's different than thinking that the danger we face is that Trump is going to end up being a fascist dictator. I am far more concerned about the other kind of axis that is possible for bad future events, and that is civil war. Not a literal civil war like our original civil war, where you have one army massing on a field against another army, all armed and shooting at each other, because our disagreements as a country are not lining up in that kind of a way that would lend itself to that kind of a battle in physical space. But just in the sense of like a polity being pulled apart into difference, into basically two polities, and one that does not line up in physical space. So what you end up with is basically men and women on opposite sides much of the time. You have like rural areas and exurbs aligned against inner ring suburbs and cities. You have college-educated Americans aligned against non-college-educated Americans. And of course, the way this parses out politically is Democrats versus Republicans, that basically what we're seeing is partisanship becoming so polarized that effectively we are two nations now, or are on the verge of becoming that. That worries me far more than Trump becoming a dictator who manages to impose his will on the non-Trumpy half or nearly half of the country, mm-hmm. or slightly more than half of the country. I think it's much more likely that Trump could win re-election again, try to do some fashy things as president, and that leads to massive unrest like in the summer of 2020, but worse than Trump sends in the Trumpified troops to shoot them, which then leads that unrest to spread much more widely mm-hmm. into mass protests in cities around the country that are then getting shot at, that kind of thing. Now, yeah. Many ways that could play out. It might not be that scenario. But I will tell you that if that is what you worried about most of all, you would take a position like, maybe we don't bother trying to prosecute Trump. There's a way right. in which I find a lot of the people who are very much on the pro-prosecute side have a kind of fantasy in their heads where this guy is bad. He's violated so many things, laws, norms, and so forth. All we need to do is just lock him up, and then we've solved the problem. We've put him in jail, which is where he belongs, and then we can get back to normal. Whereas I actually, first of all, don't think that even if we could succeed in doing that, which I'm not even sure that we would, that wouldn't bring us back to normal. In fact, it would make it worse, because then we could end up, as I said in the Times op-ed and in some things on the Substack that I've written, it's entirely possible he still runs for president from jail and becomes a kind of outlaw hero to the right, which now sees itself as explicitly organized around a hatred of the rule of law.
Right.
And that scares me a lot more. Again, not that then he wins that election and he becomes Hitler,
yeah.
but because of what the reaction on the left will be to that eventuality happening, and then what the right will do in reaction to that, and what the left will do in reaction to that, and so forth. And so when I define what stance should I take in the name of kind of the common good of this country, it's to forestall that as much as I can. And I could totally be wrong in how I think we should go about doing that, but that's the motive behind the stances that I take on these issues.
That all sounds, you know, bleakly plausible to me, unfortunately, and especially for the listeners who are hoping for a big fight here. I haven't really taken a position on the prosecute Trump or not thing. I mean, I'm sympathetic to the counter argument that if you always, for fear of undermining faith in the rule of law, just stop enforcing it, then you're kind of creating the same problem just by another way.
I just wanted to add for your listeners parenthetically so they know where I'm coming from. I want to make clear, I think this only applies to Trump, not Giuliani or Bannon or anyone else in his higher inner circle. They can be prosecuted. I think that's a perfectly reasonable and good thing to do. Similarly, and this is, some people don't know exactly why I take this position, I don't have the same aversion to a state attorney general pursuing a prosecution of him, say, in Georgia. Mm-hmm. Where he very well may have violated laws in trying to strong arm Raffensperger in order to find votes for him in Georgia. If they think they have a strong case and can actually win a conviction there, I don't think a single state trying to prosecute him raises the same kind of regime level concerns that drive my opposition.
Of Biden's DOJ
It has to do with the danger of the federal government headed by a Democratic president trying to do it. That's where it falls into the Trump narrative of this is just a political witch hunt coming after me, which I think would be very effective.
Clearly, we've already seen that it is effective for him. You know, he became even more the presumptive front runner after the FBI raid. So I can see that. Where I think I really do agree also is with the fact that this remains a political problem. Our politics are weird. But this is still a political problem. And I'm very suspicious of the impulses on the left and amongst liberals to imagine that there's some juridical or even kind of technological in terms of disinformation and stuff way out that we could just flip a switch, you know, get Trump off Twitter and ban all the Nazis and then America goes back to normal. I think that is also evading the politics to the detriment of the common good. What this leads me to think is that the best possible outcome is Trump just losing really badly again.
That's my line too.
Is that right?
Of course. The other side then responds by saying, yeah, but he did. He denied he lost the last time.
Yes.
So he'll do that again. But I say, oh, how about he loses with only 43% of the vote this time?
But this is an interesting thing because then it puts us in the position of having a really strong rooting interest in the Democrats governing well and winning elections. And that's kind of a bummer to me because then I'm like, oh, great. Now I have to just root for the Democrats again.
Yeah, I feel your pain. I still can't believe we're talking as if Trump is going to be the nominee in 2024, but it does look likely.
And, you know, Damon, I think for our purposes here, I probably come down on the side of prosecuting Trump if the evidence is actually there. But I think for our listeners, I think it's important to see that, like, you're not making this argument from a position of simple contrarianism or the kind of centrism where you just, like, the left wants this, the right wants that, and I'm going to plop myself down somewhere in the middle.
No, I don't. I never think that way. I'll piss off anyone. I mean, for instance, on foreign policy, I've had a lot of people who've assumed that because I was very much against the Iraq war, I was very much in favor of pulling out of Afghanistan. I opposed the Libya war. People have to remember we actually did participate in a war on Libya. Obama did that. You know, he said, don't do stupid shit. And then he's like, maybe a little stupid shit. People assume that because I took those positions, I must be with the Quincy Institute in opposing our support for Ukraine against Russia with the current invasion. And my position is actually, no, that's really bad. And our kind of geostrategic links with NATO are different than these kind of neo-imperialist crusades we went on in the two decades following 9/11. So I don't see these as the same. So, like, I am perfectly willing to piss off anybody on any side at any time, especially if I agreed with them the last time.
Well, Damon, that might be a good note to end on. What do you think, Sam?
Yeah, not as much. God, we really are bad at getting into big fights with our guests.
I know. It's terrible.
If you could find a Substack post that you really just thought I was the shit on, then, you know, you maybe could start something.
Exactly. That's what I should have done. Just blindsided you, Damon. And on June 6th, you wrote, Damon, you've been very generous with your time, and thank you for sharing so much with us. I thought this was a fascinating conversation, and I think our listeners will love it. I certainly did.
Great. Well, thank you for having me. It's been as much fun as I expected, and believe me, that was a lot of expectation. I love you guys. I listen to every episode, and I think you're doing a great service here.
Thanks a lot, Damon. This was fun.
Thank you, Damon.